no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. Our fearless leader, Jeff Stein, is off at the beach this week, so we will be carrying the load ourselves. And there's quite a bit to talk about. First of all, we've got a great guest to talk about those dizzying events in Alaska last week and their aftermath, the Trump-Putin summit that doesn't seem to have yielded any, certainly not any ceasefire, which was the primary goal of this summit. Our guest is Daniel Freed, former Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, former ambassador to Poland, former State Department Foreign Service officer in Russia. He's retired now, but was for years one of the U.S. government's premier experts on Putin's Russia. And he's got quite a bit to say about what happened in Alaska. But before we get to that, Karen, we do have to talk about the latest installment in our weekly Tulsi Gabbard show. She never fails to deliver material for us to talk about. And this week, she summarily stripped security clearances from 37 current and former U.S. intelligence officials on the grounds that they were somehow political enemies of President Trump. What do you make of this move by Gabbard?
I think it's really game changing, but in a way that we've been seeing coming, and I think we can expect more in the future. And I just want to contextualize this a little bit. You know, you remember that at the end of his first administration, Trump issued Schedule F, which was his way of saying we can now replace civil servants with political appointees. Project 2025 picked up that same theme. We have seen people dismissed from government, leaving government, moved from one place in government to another. And what we're seeing overall, in addition to other things, is a dismantling of much of the national security structure that was put together after 9/11. And this is just one more incident of it. And I think it's very concerning. And and it's affected a number of programs already in terms of the way Tulsi Gabbard laid out what she was trying to do. And you and I have talked about this. I mean, we had it on last week when we talked about the curtailing of the domestic terrorism program and how they don't want to have that to go forward in the same way. Now we're seeing it with throughout the intelligence community. We're seeing the Foreign Malign Influence Department diminished.
And let's not forget the FBI firing, the purge of top executives at the FBI who were deemed to be insufficiently loyal to the president's agenda. Brian Driscoll, widely popular veteran counterterrorism agent who was ordered to fire another agent for some reason Kash Patel was not approving of, or people at the White House didn't approve. Driscoll refused, said there's no cause. And then he gets fired, as does the agent who Patel wanted him to fire. you know, what's sort of stunning about this is there's really no effort to develop a cause for why these people are being purged. There's no recourse for them other than to go to court, which some of the FBI people are now planning to do. But in Gabbard's move, I mean, there's one example because she cites no evidence for what these people supposedly did. And one of them, by the name of Nguyen, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name right, Vin Nguyen, a top official at the National Security Agency who was spearheading its efforts to develop AI for national security purposes. And he gets put on the list, stripped of his security clearance, which basically means he can't do his job. And the acting director of the NSA, Lieutenant General William Hartman, calls up Gabbard and says, "What's the reason you're doing this?" And she gives no reason. And, you know, the guy is stripped of his clearance.
Well, the reason
is the reason
she's giving is redundancy, that these departments had gotten bloated over the years. And
but
that
is
they
that
can...
the reason to strip him of his security clearance?
Definitely not. I'm just
That's a reason for reducing the workforce, which is something else she's doing.
In a number of these cases, both in the security clearances and in the larger firings of hundreds of officials that we've seen, you can tie much of this to January 6th and what happened on January 6th. You can tie some of this to the Russian investigation. I mean, we do see a political narrative that goes through many of these cases, if not all of them.
Yeah, I think all of them seems to be the operative words there because this is Gabbard, who just remember, what was it, like a little more than a month ago, 6 weeks ago, seemed to be on the outs with Trump. Trump said, "I don't care what she said." This is after the Iranian strikes. And now she's done everything she could to curry favor, to get her back into good graces with El Presidente. And this seems to be a continuation of it. So something we're going to continue to talk about here at Spy Talk. But in the meantime, we are going to focus on Trump, Russia, Putin, Ukraine. As this will come up in our discussion, but to me, Trump goes into that summit demanding a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire, stop the killing. And if not, what does he say? On the way to Alaska, there will be severe consequences. He gets to Alaska, rolls out the red carpet for Putin, greets him warmly, and then Putin brushes off a ceasefire and says, "Well, let's have talks about a permanent negotiation, a permanent peace treaty," which is, as we've already seen, destined to drag on for quite some time. To me, this was as stunning a retreat, a blink, a punt, as when Barack Obama, back in 2012, said, "If Syria crosses my red line of using chemical weapons, there will be consequences." And of course, Syria did, and there were no consequences. That seems to be replaying itself here with Putin and Russia. So without any further ado, let's get to it. And we are now joined by Ambassador Daniel Freed. Ambassador, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
I was trying to think of somebody who's had more experience dealing with Vladimir Putin's Russia than you, and I couldn't. So hence your welcome invite to Spy Talk. You served in the old Soviet Union as a foreign service officer. You were ambassador to Poland. You were assistant secretary of state for European affairs, and you've been watching Vladimir Putin and Russia all these years. Give us your take on what happened in Alaska last week and where we are today in getting some kind of peace deal to end the Russia-Ukraine war.
Alaska was a mess. President Trump went into that meeting saying that he was going to push for a ceasefire and there'd be consequences for Russia if he didn't get it. Well, he didn't get it and there were no consequences. In fact, worse, Secretary of State Rubio, who's a smart guy, was on the Sunday talk show saying, oh no, we can't put economic pressure on Russia. That would spoil the atmosphere for talks. Seriously? So Trump, 48 hours ago, was talking about more pressure. Then Putin stiffs Trump and his Secretary of State says pressure's a bad idea. That's the kind of fatuous stuff from left-wing Democrats that Republicans used to make a meal of. However, Monday was much better substantively and atmospherically. The meeting with Zelensky was not a blow up in the Oval Office. And the meeting with the European leaders was actually constructive. Partly it was constructive because Trump offered something important that he had not offered before. He said that the U.S. is willing to back up the Europeans if they help secure Ukraine in a post-ceasefire or post-settlement world. The Americans had never done that before. Trump had never done that before. The French and British have led this coalition of the willing, so-called, but it's been going in circles because they know that without American backup, they really are not that credible putting forces inside Ukraine. And there's no real security for Ukraine without American backup. But Trump then said he's willing to do it. Now, Steve Witkoff said that these would be Article 5-like security guarantees. Well, what does that mean? Article 5 refers to Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, the NATO treaty, that says an attack on one is an attack on all.
But wait a second. Didn't Trump then amend, or not amend, add to that that he's not going to have U.S. troops in Ukraine? So if you take that away,
yeah, I wish
what are you left
done
with?
It tactically.
Yeah.
However, I never thought there was a chance in hell that that Trump would agree to put boots on the ground. What Trump did say we could do is air power, plus other things like intelligence and logistics. Now, if you add that up, those are enough building blocks for a competent military team to put together reassurance for Ukraine that would actually work. The Europeans are there on the ground. We would back them up. That means, remember, Article 5, right? That means we would have serious air combat units stationed outside of Ukraine, probably Poland and Romania. If the Russians went in, we would be prepared to help defend Ukraine. Now, that's a lot. But it was Witkoff, Trump's own guy, who raised Article 5. That's what Article 5 means. That is enough of a deterrent that it would cause the Russians to think twice, and it has caused the Russians to start screaming, which means we're probably on to something. Now, I'm not saying—
Does that mean we're on to a deal? The question is, where are we? And, you know, we can offer and put down all these security guarantees that we want, but the Russians would have to agree to them. And Lavrov has already kind of poured cold water on this idea, saying that Russia would have to be part of the security guarantees.
Well, there's a world of difference. You know, it's like the rabbit stew that turned out to be a combination of horse and rabbit stew in the proportions of one horse and one rabbit. Okay? There are two issues here. One, is Trump's offer a serious one? And does it open the way to serious security guarantees for Ukraine? And the answer is, it might well. The second issue is, where does this fit in a deal? The third issue is, what about the Russians? Because they hate it. okay? A deal for Ukraine involves two big issues, territory and security. Security is the more important because without it, territory doesn't matter. You can draw the line wherever you want. The Russians go to war, they'll just take more territory. So security is absolutely essential. And Trump's move, Trump's offer, if he means it, opens the way to serious security for Ukraine. Now, you raise the fact that the Russians hate it. And they will probably say there's no deal with anything like this on the table. Well, we shouldn't have to ask their damn permission. Okay? They invaded Ukraine despite the fact that the Biden people warned them not to. The Biden people in the run-up to the war offered to negotiate any Russian security concerns in Europe. Tony Blinken said so. The Russians brushed them aside and they invaded. They have not succeeded in conquering Ukraine after 3 years of war. They are unlikely to do so. So they don't get the same deal that Tony Blinken offered. I think we're going to have to stare down the Russians, and Trump is going to finally have to stare down Putin. Now, your next question might be, will Trump ever do that? To which my answer would be, I don't know. But if Trump wants a deal that's lasting, and for Trump, if he wants to show that he was tough enough to get a deal that Joe Biden couldn't, if he wants vindication, if he wants to show all his critics were wrong and he was right, he can do that. He can do that. And I'll stand up and applaud. But to do that, he's got to stare down Putin. He's got to land a deal that provides security for Ukraine. And he's got to find a way to tell Putin that it doesn't matter what Putin screams and yells about. We're going to put pressure on the Russian economy until they agree to something reasonable. And for those who say that Putin's got to get something, the prospective deal on the table would leave Russia in factual, de facto possession of big chunks of Ukraine, large enough for Putin to run victory parades and build statues to his vanity. But there has to be a stable line, and hopefully not a line that recognizes forever Russia's conquest, but is like a ceasefire line, like the line in the Korean Peninsula and the East German, West German border. All right, I've gone on, I've thrown a lot of stuff out there, so I'll shut up.
I'm really interested in this, what you call your armistice line. Mm-hmm. I think it's and I haven't seen other people, you know, talk about it the way you have. And I just, can you elaborate a little bit on what that actually means? Because in some ways, it seems a little bit like overly hopeful. But how do you see that playing out, if that could be the case, establishing that sort of not territory, not, you know, not boundary, but some kind of, you know, informal line?
Okay, so you're stuck with the Ukrainians insisting that they won't give up territory. And Zelensky says he can't. And I appreciate his position. He's right, after all, huh? And American policy for almost 100 years has been not to reward the aggressor with permanent new territory. Yeah. Stimson doctrine about the Japanese in Manchuria, Wells doctrine not recognizing the Soviet occupation of the Baltic states, and Mike Pompeo declaration. About not recognizing Crimea. Three perfectly good precedents. So you've got that on one side. And the other side is the fact that for the foreseeable future, the Russians are not going to be thrown out of Ukraine. So what do you do? That's where you hire somebody like me to come up with a formula that can bridge this. And the obvious formula for me in any of my old, you know, the old Soviet hands, terrible old men and women, is a ceasefire line that doesn't resolve the ultimate disposition, but doesn't have a time limit connected.
Well, okay? That, can I just say that would have been the ceasefire. Ceasefire lines in place. And that was what Trump said he was going for at the Alaska summit. We're now into this sort of hazy, foggy area of, you know, will there be a meeting? Will there be with Putin? Where will it be? How long? Meanwhile, the Russians are firing missiles every night, killing Ukrainians. I'm just saying, what is your sense of, I mean, you've said what you think the U.S. policy should be, but just given where we are right now, what is your sense? Are we moving towards progress, towards a peace deal, or are we stuck somewhere in quicksand?
Okay. The good news is there's a rough and steep path to a decent deal, which there wasn't a few weeks ago. The bad news is the Russians are not willing to accept it at this point. The answer is stop offering them new concessions. Stop racing after them with bouquets. Start changing the conversation by putting more pressure on the Russians, which is why I found Secretary Rubio's comments so infuriating. What are you doing? Taking off your best leverage? When we could go after Russian oil revenues? We can squeeze the Russian economy. It's not in such great shape. And by the way, while you're at it, why don't we come up with a way to finance long-term Ukrainian weapons, respecting Trump's promise that the American taxpayer won't pay, but figure out a way to do it. Lend lease, take those $280 billion of perfectly good immobilized Russian assets, mostly sitting in Europe, figure out a way to do it and tell Putin, well, I'll let that open the conversation. In other words, put some serious pressure on them rather than respond to Putin's ultimatum by figuring out a new position. Come on. The Russians know how to not negotiate for as long as they choose. But they also know how to negotiate when they want to.
Do you really think they want to? I mean,
they don't want to now. So make them want to. Look, George Kennan had a great line in 1946. The Kremlin is impervious to the logic of reason, but it's highly sensitive to the logic of force, by which he meant come up with a tough position and be prepared to back it up, and then you're not going to have to use force because they will recalculate. Putin was trained in the Soviet Union. He knows the deal. The correlation of forces is not necessarily in your favor, you take a step back. It's no big deal. So change the correlation of forces. Who's the superpower?
Right.
We have options.
Well, one thing that I'm, you know, I'm just trying to think about the security guarantee part of this and how that's, you know, the part of that that's realistic and the part of that is just sort of wishful thinking. So how different is the kind of security guarantees we've seen talked about than what it would mean to actually be a member of NATO? What's the difference?
Well, Mike McFaul, who's just great, wrote a piece saying, Article 5, like, just give him Article 5. My old colleague, Eric Edelman, whom I've known for over 50 years, and David Kramer, who I've known for 30, made the same argument. So, yeah, NATO membership is the way to go. And that would, you know, that would teach Putin. But if
would it teach Putin or would it inflame Putin and the Russian as well and lead us closer to a potential nuclear standoff?
All right. Look, I remember a conversation involving the intelligence community when some of them were saying Russia has nukes and somebody on the other side of the argument says, yes. And so do we. Okay?
Well, that sounds a bit like saber rattling.
No.
Ambassador.
They rattle the sabers. You just don't get rattled yourself. Now, however, if Trump has ruled out NATO membership for Ukraine and means it, and if we must deal with what Steve Witkoff said, our Article 5 like guarantees, I'm an old pro. I'm willing to do that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ideal, but it doesn't matter what I think. If that's what the Trump administration is willing to do, okay. Can it work? And the answer is, yeah, it could work. But you're going to have to stare down Putin at some point. And you're not going to stare them down by constantly backing off. We have some options and we should take them. And after all, the Russians would get something out of a deal. They are in trouble right now. Their military is stretched. Their economy is not good. Their casualties are high. They are not about to conquer Ukraine. I've been reading articles in the mainstream media for 3 years that they were about to do it. That, you know, the last was this salient the Russians got, you know, by infiltrating Ukrainian lines near Pokrovsk. And it was supposed to, it was the latest version of the big breakthrough. Well, the Ukrainians called in reinforcements and the salient is now chopped into pieces. It doesn't mean the Ukrainians are winning. It means that I am tired of the same article being written that the Russians will inevitably beat the Ukrainians. There's a certain style of academic and a certain style of journalist that thinks they're being hard-bitten realists when what they are actually doing is worshiping power.
And now we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking to Ambassador Fried about what he thinks might make the Russians cave. And we're back with Ambassador Dan Fried. Now, critics might say once the Ukrainian counteroffensive in 2023 failed, it was pretty clear that there was no strategic path to dislodge the Russians from the territory that they already occupied. And so that said, critics will say what you're really prescribing is a perpetuation of the war with no end in sight. We don't know what will make the Russians cave. We know how strongly Putin feels about Ukraine being, a part of Russia going back hundreds and hundreds of years. Those critics would say what you're proposing here is riskier than any alternative.
Well, let's unpack that. Some of what you said is really pretty solid. That is,
that's
the Ukrainians are not about to drive the Russians out of Ukraine.
All right, let's talk about the part that you think is not.
Okay, but let's, and I will also, I take seriously Trump's argument that Biden was treading water and it's time to push this war to a close. And he could do it. So the way to do it is to recognize that the front line isn't going to move that much. So you freeze it in place and you have an armistice. And Putin keeps what he's got, but we don't have to recognize it. And you find some language to bridge that gap, and then you have to have security for Ukraine. Now, that's the deal. And that's right. The deal that's on the table, and it's the deal that Trump was touting on Monday, basically. And I will say that he's right. And he is in a position to say that I, Donald J. Trump, am driving this forward to end the war while Joe Biden was just treading water forever. And he has a case. So I would say to your critics, okay.
Yeah.
But you don't want a deal that is so bad that you end up looking like a sucker.
I mean, some could argue that, the ceasefire that Trump said he was going for would accomplish what you're talking about. But once he got away from that, it seems we're in this slow walking, miasma, and we don't know where it's going.
Well, you have a point, and I think that Trump was wrong to give up on the ceasefire, okay?
Yes.
I'm just stipulated. That was a mistake.
Can I just say, I just break in there, you know what it reminds me of a little bit, and I'd like to get your reaction to this. Remember Obama's red line in Syria when he said, if Assad uses chemical weapons, that's my red line, and then when push came to shove, he abandoned it.
Got it.
But this seems, in many ways, very similar.
Okay. But, when I was when I had a steady job, I'm steady now at the Atlantic Council, but when I was in government, my task was not to think of the best possible policy, but whether I could work with the policy I had and make it a success? And the question, that the answer is, I can take Trump's outline and make it a success, which means I'm not the only one. If I can do it, others can do it. So what has to be done is to drive this forward, make real this coalition of the willing and American backup. That gets the Ukrainians willing to consider issues of territory, right? Then you figure out a formula on territory that doesn't mean the Russians have it forever, but bridges that gap. And then you make sure that Putin feels some extra heat. Now, your counter to that is, well, what if it doesn't work? Well, let's try some extra heat. Let's try using our assets. Take a whack at Russian income from the sale of oil. That's basically propping up their economy. We can do something about that. Make sure we have a formula in place that provides a steady flow of American weapons to Ukraine that the American taxpayer doesn't have to pay for. It shouldn't be all the Europeans. Maybe you can do a lend-lease arrangement. Trump has mentioned that before. Anyway, figure that out and keep pushing Putin. Don't drive this forward, but don't take the Russian initial nyets as the final answer. Keep squeezing them and mean it. If you're in a hurry to do a deal, be in an equal hurry to set the conditions to make it more possible to do a deal. Don't do what Biden did, which is slow walk everything, including your escalation. You know, remember Biden would, the people would wring their hands and dither every 6 months about a weapon system? What are you kidding me? Why can't we have a combination of the thoroughness of the Biden administration analysis and the drive of Trump to get stuff done? Can I have something in the middle here, please? But push it forward. You know, look what Trump has done. 2 weeks ago, there wasn't a plausible path to a settlement. Now there is, and he can take credit. Well, to get the credit, drive it home, man. Mean it. Do it. You know, collect that Nobel Peace Prize, but first you got to have peace.
You have been watching and dealing with Vladimir Putin for several decades now. And I believe you've had some personal experiences with him. So tell us a little about your sense of Putin right now. I just want to preface that a little bit because a couple of years ago, remember, the narrative was he's isolated, he's ill, he's, you know, there's something wrong with him. He's teetering in power. He looks totally in control at the moment.
I knew Vladimir Putin as a staffer in happier days. I was there with President Bush when he first met Putin in June 2001 in Slovenia at Brdo Castle. We had hopes in someone we didn't yet know, and those hopes were ill-founded. I'm not sorry we tried. And I get why Mike McFaul tried the reset with the Obama administration. I didn't think it would work, but I'm not going to bust him. He was trying to do the same thing we were trying to do for the same reasons.
Putin, and why don't they work?
It didn't work because Putin's conditions for decent relations with the U.S. have come to be, you let me be oppressive at home and aggressive abroad. I want my empire back, and you have to stand back. You have to get out of my way. And on that basis, Putin's ready to work with us, but on the basis of us allowing him to conquer countries like Georgia or Ukraine and murder his opponents. And that's a deal that no American president has been willing to take, even though Obama wanted to do a deal. He wasn't willing to face the consequences of the deal that Putin was offering. That's a fact. Now, is Putin implacable? I don't know. I tend to think he's in the Soviet model of advance until you encounter resistance, and then you can retreat. It's that George Kennan quote I used earlier.
You know, Lavrov showed up in Alaska wearing a sweatshirt, right? that said
USSR.
USSR in Cyrillic. The message, so the reason I'm bringing that up is the optics of we're willing to make a deal about territory, right? That's evolving now. You know, at what point is it, if you're the Europeans, you know, if you're the coalition of the willing, et cetera, how much does allowing Putin to keep territory in whatever formal or informal guise, how does that reverberate in terms of the European countries, which from the very beginning of this have talked about not wanting Putin to be able to reconstitute some kind of empire?
Well, they're right. Okay?
Yeah.
They're right. And by the way, if I were in Anchorage advising Trump, I would have advised Trump to tell Putin to knock it off with the USSR stuff.
Yep.
And Trump could have said to Putin, your foreign minister thinks it's funny. You're not getting the empire back.
What was your reaction when you saw that sweatshirt?
That he was trolling us, that they were arrogant, and that we should respond appropriately, meaning push back. You don't have to take shit from these people. They haven't earned it. I would also remind him that he's been at war with Ukraine for 3 years and hasn't managed to roll them up. So don't talk to me about the might of Russia. But you know, there's an old rule that the Russians pitch their level of bullshit based on their estimation of their interlocutor's level of ignorance. So in other words, you better know what you're talking about and be quick on your feet. Don't take that crap from them. But then you don't have to scream and yell. Just don't take any nonsense.
Yeah.
And then you can get down to business.
So last question for you. You talked about how you were there with George W. Bush when he first met.
In happier Putin days.
And the high hopes. When did things turn? And what do you think turned Putin into this guy who you thought might be a friendly bureaucrat into this, you know, oppressive dictator?
Look, I think I know.
Okay.
Okay. It was the color revolutions, the pro-Western political upheaval in Ukraine and Georgia 2004-2005 that we had nothing to do with. We didn't engineer that. But Putin thought we did. He led us in large NATO to bring in the Baltic states. That was a George W. Bush decision. And he let us do it. And that was on us. I'm glad we did it. He took it. We had nothing to do with the color revolutions, but he thought we did. He blamed us. And I think that's when he turned against us, because we were violating his terms for good relations, which is that he's master in his empire, in his sphere of domination. That's what I think happened. But I'll tell you another story. George W. Bush was on to Putin a lot earlier than people thought. I was with Bush when he flew to London in October 03 to see Tony Blair, and it was mainly about the Iraq War, and that's what everybody remembers, those huge anti-war demonstrations in London. But they started talking about Putin, and this was not in their papers, I promise you. They were in complete agreement that Putin was not the man we thought he was. That's what they said. Mm. They didn't like the oppression. They didn't like him going after free speech in Russia. And they were both shaking their heads. They were well ahead of Condi Rice and Colin Powell. This was Bush. He knew. I have to give him credit, because Bush has taken a lot of heat for that. You know, I looked into his eyes and got a glimpse of his soul.
Right.
Like, I get that. But Bush was on to Putin. It didn't mean we weren't going to try to work with him. We tried that up into the Georgian War in 2008. But Bush was no sucker. And it was interesting that what made Bush suspicious of Putin was the anti-democratic moves. Not what people generally think, but I was witness to that and I never forgot it.
Witness to
that Bush conversation between Bush and Blair.
Right.
And I promise you it wasn't in his notes, because I wrote the papers.
And that was 2003, I gather. 2003. Yeah.
So Bush got this stuff. You know, right. I gotta give the guy credit. He knew what he was dealing with. Didn't mean we weren't gonna try to work with Putin.
Yeah.
There were reasons to do so. I get it. You know, I supported the policy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after the color revolutions, it was pretty clear to me where Putin was headed. And I was, there were a couple of us in the Bush administration who were hawkish on Putin before it was fashionable. But that, anyway, that's old. That's old history.
Well, then I got to ask one last question, because you were a part of the, in fact, on your bio on the Atlantic Council, you talked about you helped to craft the policy of NATO enlargement in Central and Eastern Europe, which, of course, is what drives Putin crazy. And it's what he will always bring up. And to be fair, there were senior American statesmen, James Baker, Robert Gates, who raised questions about whether that was the right move to expand NATO onto the doorstep of Russian territory.
Well, I'm glad we did it. I think we're completely vindicated. Look, if we hadn't brought the Baltic states and Poland into NATO, there wouldn't be a war in Ukraine. There'd be a war in Poland, an occupation of the Baltic states, an occupation of Ukraine. Right? You don't think so? Look what the Russians are claiming. I'm glad we did it.
Mm-hmm.
We used the window of opportunity we had. In fact, Clinton understood perfectly well the debate. Very shrewd guy. And he talked about this last year in Prague. He said he tried to do two things, is to reach out to Russia and enlarge NATO, because you had to do both. And the part with Russia didn't work out, but the NATO enlargement part just worked out fine. So do the counter history. Yeah. Had we left the Baltic states and Poland in a gray zone, you think Putin would have said thank you? No, he would have taken it as a green light to take them back. You don't think so? Read his articles. I mean, he's all hung up with the 17th century. I'm glad we did it. You don't get more vindicated than that.
Ambassador,
I'll hang with that position.
We were looking with somebody with some historical sweep for this podcast, and you have more than delivered. We could go on, but I know you're short on time. But I just want to thank you. It's a great discussion, and I hope we can have you back as events unfold.
Happy to do it. A pleasure to go through this. And I will say one last thing. My professional experience ought to be irrelevant. My stories ought to be suitable for some, you know, for students who would pretend to be interested while actually falling asleep. But it's relevant because Putin is still wants the empire back. It shouldn't be, but it is.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And we will continue the conversation. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawk for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.